Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be joined by Professor Adrian Tinniswood to discuss his book titled Noble Ambitions, The Fall and Rise of the Post-War Country House, which really does exactly what it says and answers what I think are some fascinating questions. Because if we look around Britain today, we've got a bunch of country houses. And yet, if we go back to World War II, that might not have been the outcome we thought we were going to end up with. So there's very much a puzzle and a number of questions to investigate and understand here. And that's exactly what Adrian's done in this book. So Adrian, thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you for asking me, Miran.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I've been interested in country houses ever since I left university, which is far too long ago to remember. I started work at the National Trust House in Derbyshire, my home county, a place called Sudbury Hall. And I wasn't interested in country houses. I wasn't particularly interested in history. And the minute I set foot in that house, I fell in love. And I've been obsessed with country houses ever since, in all their different guises, big, small, rich, poor, lost and found. I wrote a book a few years back called The Long Weekend, which was about the country house between the two world wars. And it was a time, conventionally, it was a time when the country house was said to be in crisis. And I found out as I went along that, well, there was a narrative of crisis, of demolition and destruction and decay. There was a parallel narrative, which was all about new money, new houses, a dynamic, exciting place to be. And I wrote extensively about the country house in the 20s and 30s. And then I started to think about, well, what happened after the war? You know, after the war, again, conventionally, that's when the country house was in an even deeper crisis. And I just wanted to unpick what life was like in the country house in the 50s and 60s.
Well, let's start doing that now then. Before we get into, I suppose, the houses themselves, I want to talk about kind of the context of them so that we better understand what's happening in them when we get there. What was the debate like about the country house, the role of the country house, if we go back to sort of the end of World War II? What were people talking about? What were they upset about? Who was even having these conversations?
Sure. I mean, one of the issues, I think, was taxation. And with Attlee's Labour government and a drive towards redistributive taxation, the notion of death duties, which had been introduced in one form or another in the 1890s, had been growing until in the years immediately after the war. They were standing at 65%, 75%. By 1950, they were 80%. Now, if you had, no matter how wealthy you were, if you had to find 80% of the value of your assets, you were stuffed. You couldn't do it. So taxation was the axe that was kind of hovering over the country house, I think. And it was tricky because, well, country house owners were saying that they performed an important function. They were custodians of an important facet of British heritage, British history. Nevertheless, asking in 1945, asking for tax breaks at a time when Britain was in was not in the happiest state, let's say, those austere post-war years, was very tricky indeed. And there was a sense, I think, that the country house had had its day. Certainly that the social milieu, of which the country house was an expression, but that had had its day.
Which is fascinating to think about, given where we ended up. What was the government's perspective on all of this? Were they involved in the debates? Did they have a thought about what would happen, or were they just kind of trying to keep out of it?
No, the Labour government actually was quite anxious about what to do. They didn't know what to do. In 1949, they invited the civil servant, Ernest Gowards, to head up a committee of inquiry into houses of outstanding historical architectural interest to look at what could be done. I mean, there was a sense, as there is today, I think, there was an assumption that the best people to look after country houses were the families who lived in them. Now, that we can, at some point, we can unpick that. And I think it's quite it's not as straightforward as one might think. Because, of course, in whose interest is it for the people who lived in country houses to be subsidised? Well, it's in the interest of the people who lived in country houses, isn't it? And that kind of ambivalence, if you like, that kind of anxiety about what the right thing to do for a country. But the alternative was to let them fall. And that's what happened to so many of them. I mean, although I firmly believe that the 40s and 50s and 60s were quite rich periods when it comes to the country house. They were quite exciting times. Nevertheless, that parallel narrative of the country house in crisis really blossomed and bloomed in the 40s and 50s. I mean, there is a statistic which is often bandied about, and it's pretty much true, that one stately home a week was being demolished in 1955. The country house was doomed, as far as most people thought.
Today, though, there's another option. There's either it gets saved or maintained by the family that lives in it or sold, it gets demolished or collapses, or it goes to the National Trust. Why wasn't the National Trust more of an option in the 50s?
It was an option. It was an option then, as it had been. Changes in legislation in the late 1930s and the National Trust Country House scheme meant that the Trust was able to take over country houses. That was honed in the 40s and early 50s so that the Treasury could take a country house in lieu of payment of death duties and hand it over to the National Trust to look after it. And that did happen. But only with a fraction of the number of country houses. I mean, the National Trust didn't have limitless coffers. And these days, of course, I mean, certainly since the 60s, I guess, the National Trust, to take on a country house, has asked for a fairly hefty endowment. You didn't just give your stately home to the National Trust. You gave them your stately home plus £1 million or something to look after it in perpetuity. So the Trust, although it was important, and remains important. I mean, heaven knows the world would be a much greyer place without the National Trust. But it was only ever able to look after or to save a fraction of the country. I mean, there are some, even with the demolitions, Miranda, there are something today like 2,000, maybe 3,000 country houses surviving in Britain. The National Trust couldn't look after all of them, nor did their owners want them to, of course. But there's still that sense almost of panic. I mean, there's a great quote. When Eddie Devonshire, the 10th Duke of Devonshire, died in 1950, he had made over his estate to his son. And as part of that, there was the period of before the deed of gift kicked in. It was 3 years, it was 5 years, it's now 7 years. That had 14 weeks left to run. And that meant that because the Duke of Devonshire died 14 weeks, 100 days too soon, his son and heir was liable for all the tax, for something, in today's terms, it will be several billion pounds, colossal sum. And the 11th Duke said, you know, I don't think we can save Chatsworth. He was wrong in that, but he said, I don't think we can save Chatsworth, but I don't want to be the one to let it go. And that notion, I don't want to be the one, is what informs so much desperate sort of scrabbling around for money and for alternative uses that the country house owners were looking for in the 50s and 60s.
So let's get into some of the things that they tried. What were some of these desperate scrabbling around? What were some of the alternative uses, and did any of them pan out?
Well, the most obvious one, I suppose, and the most enduring one, was to open your house to the public. As a commercial venture, I mean, houses have always been open to the public. The polite tourist in Georgian England trotted around Blenheim and Chatsworth and Kedleston. Even in the late 16th century. We've got a reverse grand tour. Well, usually a young Protestant nobleman from some of the German states and Eastern European states would come to England. They would spend time in London. They would go and see a show. Maybe, as one young man in 1600 went to see a play called The Moor of Venice.
He's actually going to see Othello.
It's incredible when it's first put on. So tourists had always been visiting country houses. You would go to London as a foreign tourist in late 16th century England. You would also go to Oxford and Cambridge, and you would stop off at the royal palaces. You would go to Richmond. You would go to Hampton Court. You would go to Whitehall. And you would go to some of the big Elizabethan prodigy houses. So houses had always been open. And the attendants had usually got a tip. You know, there was no formal admission fee. But, you know, the housekeeper that showed you around usually wanted, you know, a couple of bob. By the 1940s, and in fact, although houses were open to the public for money, at least in the early 20th century, probably before that, but the man who's usually credited with starting the stately home business, the industry, if you like, is Marquess of Bath at Longleat. In April 1949, he opened Longleat to the public as a commercial venture. And this was because he already had the Cheddar Caves on the edge of his estate in Somerset, and they had been open to the public at a shilling a time since about 1900 or so. And he thought, well, if we can do that, why don't we try and open the house? Why don't we see if there's a taste for the public taste for stately homes? And in those austere, rather grey post-war years, he found that there was. Longleat was a tremendous success. And as Longleat took off, so others went into the stately home business. Edward Montague, Lord Montague at Bewley, he had a not particularly exciting country house now in the New Forest, but he was a consummate publicist, and he decided to add value to his country house by installing a motor museum there. He didn't actually have any motor cars, which was a bit of a stopper, but he begged, borrowed, and not stole exactly, but acquired all kinds of motor cars and motor car memorabilia, and opened Bewley to the public as both a country house and a motor museum. Shortly after him, the 13th Duke of Bedford, Ian Russell, decided, again faced with a massive bill for death duties, he decided to open Woburn Abbey to the public. And again, it was a fantastic success. Something like 37,000 people turned up at Woburn one bank holiday weekend. Everybody went away happy. One person at least went away with a new dog because of the Duke of Bedford's dog was stolen on the first day and never seen again. He also discovered that not every member of the public behaved impeccably when he discovered a woman with a pair of scissors snipping a piece of damask out of the curtains in the drawing room at Woburn Abbey because she wanted to take it home and match it so she could have it reproduced. But Woburn, Bewley, Longleat were among some of the first. Chatsworth was open to the public for a fee from 1950 onwards, as it had been open before the war to a certain extent. So you see a growing interest in commercialising, in maximising your assets, if you like. And it becomes, you know, by the late 60s, early 70s, it becomes a huge business with something, I think by 71, 72, there's something like 7 million visits a year to private stately homes, private country houses.
Mm, that is pretty expansive. You talk about in the book, though, that it wasn't just tourists that would come in and look at the houses. They were opened up for some other purposes as well. I wonder if you can talk to some of those?
Are we talking about lions here?
We are. Yes, please. Tell us about the lions.
One of the odder manifestations of the stately home business in the late 60s was the growth of the safari park. And this is a strange one. It begins with Jimmy Chipperfield, who was part of the Chipperfield circus family and who left the circus family in the 50s, in the 60s. He ran his own business, sort of hiring out lions and tigers and various animals and actually catching them in Africa, bringing them back to England. Not very, not particularly in tune with 21st century sensibilities. But he also thought why were people were going to Africa to see these animals, why not bring them to England? And instead of putting them in cages at a zoo, allow them to roam free. So he went to a chap whose name escapes me, David Booth, I think it was, at Hale Park in the New Forest, and who was looking for a new venture. And Jimmy Chipperfield said to him, you know, let's use your park, your landscape park, as a huge enclosure. And he was David was keen. His mother, his octogenarian mother, was not. She said, "It's all very well, but I know it'll happen. You'll go off, and I'll be left to feed the lions on my own." So that idea was squashed. But as he was leaving after a lunch at Hale Park, Jim Chipperfield was stopped by David Booth, who said, "I know somebody who might be interested," and that was the Marquess of Bath at Longleat. Longleat had been a great success when it opened in 1949. By the mid-60s, early 70s, it was not as successful as some of the other big names, as Chatsworth, as Blenheim. So the Marquess of Bath was looking for added attractions. And to cut a very long story short, he and Chipperfield together formed a partnership. Chipperfield was to provide the lions, and the Marquess of Bath would provide the setting for them. When he went to for planning, the Marquess of Bath rather disingenuously said he wanted to put up a fence to keep stock in. He didn't say the stock were lions. Jimmy Chipperfield, when word got round he was looking for lions, a film company in Nairobi who had just finished making Born Free, the film Joy Adamson's escapades, said that they got these spare lions and he could have them for 10 quid each. So they, in the face of enormous opposition initially, you know, these lions were going to escape, they were going to ravage the Wiltshire countryside, they were going to eat sheep and cattle. The Times said, "The place for lions is in heraldry. Sheep and cattle should be good enough for a Wiltshire man." Everybody said it was going to be a disaster, and it was a phenomenal success, which meant that other country house owners started to look at the idea of safari parks and going into business 50-50 basis with Chipperfield. The Duke of Bedford did this at Woburn. In 1970, Woburn Safari Park opened at the cost a massive amount of money to put in the infrastructure, the roads, the fencing, the compounds. And to begin with, it was a disaster. Nobody came. Nobody drove through. Incidentally, the Marquess of Bath, when he was first told about the idea by Jimmy Chipperfield, said, "Well, aren't we going to have to build awfully big cages if people are going to drive through them?" He didn't get the idea at all. He finally did get it. But the Duke of Bedford, as I say, invested a colossal amount, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions, we're not quite clear, in the new safari park at Woburn. And nobody came. Nobody came. It was going to be a catastrophe. And then one day, 3 months after Woburn opened, a woman was driving through with some friends and with a little girl in the back of her car. And it was a hot day. The window was open. The little girl was hanging out of the car. And a lion called Twiggy mauled her. She was seriously hurt. She survived, but she was seriously hurt. And the Duke of Bedfield and Jimmy Chipperfield thought, "That's it. It's an absolute disaster." The next week, the roads around Woburn Abbey were gridlocked with people desperately trying to visit Woburn to see where this little girl had been. Aren't the public odd? Isn't the public spreading? They slobs, but he wanted. And Woburn never looked back after that. It saved the Duke of Bedford's fortunes, he said. For the first time in his life, he had money in the bank because of the safari park and indirectly because of that little girl.
Wow. All right. Well, let's talk then about some of the things that were done in country houses when the owners did get some money from things like this or have some perhaps left over. What sorts of events were being held in country houses that weren't open to the public? Were these just kind of continuation of what was happening before the war? I mean, we think about things like royal visits or debutante balls. Were those the same as they had been?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Yes, royalty continued to visit. Both Princess Margaret, who didn't have a country house of her own, unlike the other members of the royal family, but Princess Margaret, the Queen, Duke of Edinburgh, the Queen Mother, were regular visitors with friends of, you know, to friends of theirs. Also, the social side of a country house continued. You know, the hum balls went on. The one thing you did see, in fact, was the debutantes' balls. The last royal season was 1958, but debutantes' balls coming out went on right through into the 60s. In fact, probably going on today for all I know. The idea of a debutante ball was becoming very expensive. If you held it in London, as they were, yes, they have been in the past. However, if you went in with another couple of sets of parents and either borrowed a country house or used your own country house, it was a lot cheaper. So we see debutante balls taking place in country houses rather than in town more and more in the 50s and 60s. I mean, they had their own logistic problems. If you were going to a ball in town, then most people had places to stay in town. If you didn't, you got a hotel to stay in. In the country, it was rather more difficult. You had to farm people, you had to farm guests out. You might have 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 guests. You got to find somewhere for them to stay. No matter how big your country house was, they couldn't stay with you. You haven't got room. So you roped in neighbours and friends with substantial houses. And basically you farmed out your guests to those friends. It was, these parties were, obviously they were quite wild, some of them. You tended to have, obviously, live music. Tommy Kinsman and his band, The Deb's Delight, he was called, because he and his band cropped up everywhere, both in London and in the country. He was quite expensive to have along, but he might have two or three bands. The one constant in the accounts of country house balls that I've read, the one constant is people ending up in a swimming pool. There seem to have been a lot of swimming pools in country houses in the 1950s and 60s, and usually around about 3 or 4 o'clock, half the guests ended up in them. They're young people. They're actually, compared to today, they're fairly innocent. Although I think it was Fiona McCarthy, who was one of the last royal debutantes in 58, she said, you know, there was a lot of kissing, but that was more or less it. It was fairly, you know, it was fairly kind of chaste, the whole business. There were no drugs until the late 60s, when when swinging London was at its height and drugs appeared on the scene, and people maybe drank a little bit too much. Most people didn't. They were fairly well behaved affairs and fairly well regulated as well, because there would be a strong contingent of parents and aunts and chaperones and such things, even in the 60s.
Mm. If we're imagining then these affairs, including, of course, the swimming pools, were there domestic servants still in country houses that would have been sort of visible parts of things like this?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one, I think. You know, we'd been hearing about the servant problem since before the First World War. In 1900, 1901, you know, domestic servants, and this is predominantly female domestic servants, formed the biggest occupational group in Britain. I mean, there's 1.5 million, I think, women were in domestic service, indoor domestic service. But it was getting harder to find servants. After the First War, when there's a Royal Commission looking at the servant problem, you know, the reasons were made fairly clear. Alternative employment, better hours, less indignity, less being ordered about all the time, made to wear uniforms, called by your surname. And women were more and more reluctant. It had always been a fairly sort of temporary occupation. Now, we tend to think of service being a lifetime career. For most, it wasn't. Most women went into service when they were 14. They married when they were about 26, 27 and came out of service, because there were no married couples in service in the 19th century, or very, very few. By the 1940s, that's all changed. Servants are much rarer. However, I can't think of a single country house in the 40s or 50s that did not have servants. They might not have had, you know, in the 1920s, the Astors at Clifton had, I think, 28 or 29 indoor servants, plus an army of outdoor servants. Now, you might not have had 28 servants, but you would have half a dozen, maybe a dozen. There would be a butler, there would be a housekeeper, cook, there would be a couple of maids. Increasingly, though, that model is changing. So we see the arrival of married couples, typically a married gardener, chauffeur, and housekeeper, cook, with their own accommodation. We see the arrival, or the importance, if you like, of dairies coming in from the village. Women not living in, but coming in to help at table or to clean. The thing is that if you've got a country house with, I don't know, 200 or 300 rooms in it, 20 bedrooms, 20 main bedrooms, 7 or 8 reception rooms, coal fires, you can't look after that by yourself. One person cannot maintain that. Now, either you bite the bullet, and even though you can't quite afford it, you keep servants. And of course, keeping servants is still a status thing. It's not just about convenience. It's about showing that you're not as badly off as you really are in lots of ways. You either do that, or you do what some families did, and you retreat. You move into the kitchen. You live in the kitchen, and you sleep in one of the little parlours that are sort of tucked away somewhere. You close up the staterooms. You cover them in dust sheets. You only open them once or twice a year for the annual hunt ball, or when the county comes to dine. So you've got to, and even then, it would be most unusual for you not to have, say, a leader cook, housekeeper. Some country houses, and there were new country houses built, something like, I don't know, it's hard to be exact, but I know of 85, 90 brand new country houses built in the 1950s and 60s. So although houses were being demolished, they're being built at the same time. And one or two of those was, I think, Knowsley Hall outside Liverpool, the Earl of Derby's house, was built in 1956 with accommodation for a dozen servants, which was quite unusual at the time. So servants were still part of life. And there were, as I say, there were the dailies coming in. There were au pairs, of course, arriving on the scene in the 50s and 60s. There were drives to recruit servants from Germany and Eastern Europe in the 40s and 50s, bringing foreign servants over to do work that Brits wouldn't do, which is a familiar story, I think.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And interesting to see links there that maybe we hadn't expected with how service worked in country houses. But the thing I most want to pick up from, I think, from that answer is the new country houses, because given the statistics you started us off with, it is odd that people were building new ones.
Yeah.
Why were new ones being built? Who was building them? Were they, I mean, you talk about in the book some kind of very odd ones. So I'm wondering if you can give us examples of strangest might have looked like.
So, I mean, country houses were being built then, and it's worth remembering that country houses are still being built today. And now, as then, they tended to be neoclassical or Palladian lookalikes. They tended to be more convenient. You know, you didn't have a kitchen that was 100 yards from the dining room anymore. You had, you know, electric lighting and proper heating plumbed in. They were more convenient than a Victorian pile which had been adapted and endlessly remodeled, you know, to take new labour-saving devices. You could install those. And it also said something about you. It said that you were really quite rich. The King's Waldenbury was a beautiful sort of neo-Palladian house built by the architect Raymond Erith in 1968. One of my favourites is a house called Stainsby in Derbyshire, near Smalley, which is, it looks like the set of Star Trek. It's wonderfully weird, with curving lines, white walls, flat roof. It's a marvellous piece of science fiction. And it's a proper country house. There were modernist country houses being built, tending to be rather smaller than their Palladian counterparts. But there were good modernist, there were good glass boxes being built, really exciting and interesting houses being built in the 50s and 60s. They did tend to be smaller, though. They did tend to be more convenient. And they often tended not to have a big estate with them. Maybe, grounds and a park, secure views, but not the kind of thousands of acres that set the country house traditionally at the heart of a great agricultural estate. Those days were passing, I think.
Okay, that's a useful distinction to make. we've spoken about then country houses that are, whether it's through lions, hung on to, country estates that collapse, demolish, etc., new country houses that are built. What about ones where the house stays, but it's sold and ends up not being part of the original family, but is sold to someone else? Was it easy to sell a country house? Kind of which ones were able to be sold? And I think most importantly, who was buying them?
Yeah, this is a really good point, I think. Whether or not it was easy to sell a country house depended a great deal on what that country house was. You see estate agents in the post-war period extolling the virtues of a small country house, somewhere with, you know, 8 or 10 bedrooms and 2 or 3 grand reception rooms, as opposed to, you know, a Blenheim or a Chatsworth or a Harwood House or something like that. The smaller, more compact country house, a country house that was closer to London or to a major conurbation in some way, was easier to sell. Apart from anything else, it was also easy to get servants for. The country house owners in the 50s talked about servants applying for a position and taking one look at the house, which is down a 2-mile drive or something, and thinking, this isn't for me. So a house that was near to town, that was smaller, more convenient, they would sell. They sold, you know, we forget that country, as part of the country house crisis of the 50s, country houses were being sold. Families were selling up. They were leaving. They couldn't manage. But as those houses were being sold, most of them weren't being demolished. They were being bought by someone else. There are new owners. And I think quite often, because we obsess, rather, obsess is too sore a word, but because we're naturally interested in the long-lineaged, high-pedigreed country house owner, like the Dukes of Devonshire, like the Dukes of Bedford, like the Marquess of Bath, we forget that most country houses did not belong to aristocracy. And in fact, an awful lot of country houses didn't belong to the people who built them or people who lived in them for a generation or two. There was a churn. They'd always changed hands. And I think one of the interesting things about the post-war period is that the saviours of the British country house were not just the owners, the aristocrats. They were not just the National Trust. They were young entrepreneurs who had made their money. The 50s equivalent of technocrats today or Silicon Valley innovators today, people who have made their money and wanted a country house. Now, they might not live in it for more than 10 or 15 years. They might move on. They might not have a huge estate to go with it. But these people cherished their country houses just as much as somebody who'd lived in them for 10 generations. They were precious to them. They poured money into them. They saved the country house. There are no end of younger families. I say younger. I mean, people in their sort of 30s and 40s who had made a lot of money in business and who bought a small country house because they, either because they wanted to live in it or because they wanted a weekend retreat, which, of course, the country house had become in the 30s and 40s and 50s. It was a weekend retreat rather than a primary residence. And these people loved their country houses. That's what we forget. They weren't all tasteless and irresponsible. They were, well, I've said it, they saved the country house.
And what role did the government have in the saving of the country houses? If we pick up the thread from the beginning about the impact of taxes and kind of the ambivalence about the extent to which these should be preserved and by whom, if we get to the point of the 60s or 70s, what's the role of the government in this?
It's actually fairly arm's length. The government does grant tax concessions. It does institute mechanisms whereby houses can be, or works of art can be given in lieu of death duties to the state. And it also sets up, in the wake of the Gowers Committee report, it sets up a series of historic buildings and monuments commissions for England, Wales and Scotland. Northern Ireland doesn't have one until the 70s, 72. But those HBMCs, those Historic Buildings and Monuments Commissions, are empowered to give or to advise, to recommend grants, small grants, usually fairly small grants, to private country house owners. Now, the deal always is, yes, you get public money, but we want public benefit. So large numbers of houses, even ones that are open today, you know, for on a Wednesday afternoon and Sunday afternoon or something like that, typical, you know, May to September, typical old-fashioned opening hours, they're open because they have accepted grants from the government, and therefore they are obliged to open to the public. Public benefit, public money. The equation is quite clear, and successive governments, didn't matter what complexion the government was, that was the deal. If you wanted a grant to renew your roof or to deal with the dry rot, you had to open your house to the public.
That is a very straightforward equation to say, but of course a harder one to enact. Could we in fact talk a little bit about that? Obviously, at the beginning, you already detailed many of the ways in which opening up the houses to the public could be very successful. But it wasn't always successful, or there were sort of teething problems, I suppose. You discussed some things that house owners perhaps had to learn about opening their houses to the public. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about that? I mean, today it just seems so seamless. It's like there's big signs and it's all very clear, but it wasn't always this way, right?
I've got to tell you, Miranda, it might seem seamless. It ain't. But no, and it was more, even more complex then. You know, you had to provide lavatories. The Duke of Bedford said that one of the things that people always complained about was the state of the lavatories, even though we used to steal the toilet paper and break the chains. You had to provide car parking. You had to provide tea rooms. People expected tea rooms. You had to provide a gift shop, just selling postcards and guidebooks and pencils, probably. The Duke of Bedford found that if he did a stint in the Woburn Abbey gift shop every afternoon, sales doubled because everybody wanted to buy their pencil or their postcard from a duke. And so the Duke of Bedford, who would do anything to make money for Woburn, he loved the place, he did a two-hour stint in the guidebook every, in the gift shop every afternoon. In fact, he would also, I mean, he went to all kinds of lengths. Most famously, in 1958, the Duke of Bedford hosted the World Naturist Congress, a nudist camp at Woburn. What's less well known is that not only did he host the nudist camp, but he did a deal with a soft porn filmmaker who wanted to make what was a film called Nudist Paradise, which was billed as Britain's first full-length nudist film. And they used the unsuspecting extras, unsuspecting nudists at Woburn as extras. If anyone's seen that film, I'd love to get a copy, purely for research purposes, of course. I've not managed to find it. So the Duke of Bedford, he installed a milk bar at Woburn. And I've got to tell you, in 1958, it did not get any cooler than that. A milk bar was it. He advertised dishwashers. His wife and the daughters advertised cosmetics. He went on television with Lord Montague, and I'm not sure if Lord Bath was there, but they sang the Stately Homes of England, of course. You know, he would do anything to promote Woburn. And there are a number of these showman peers. I mean, people look down their nose at them, but what could they do? You know, they couldn't just sit back and watch the money roll in, because it didn't. Even houses like Woburn and Chatsworth and Blenheim and Bewley and Longleat, even houses like that that were really successful, they were barely covering their costs. They weren't making a fortune for their owners at all. So diversifying and going in for safari parks, film locations was another big money earner. The Duke of Rutland found in the 1960s when he rented Beaver Castle out to a film company making a largely forgettable sub-James Bond film. he found that for 10 days filming, they'd give him £2,000, which was wonderful. Not only that, but if ever they wanted to use any of the heirlooms at Beaver or any of the furniture, he said, of course you can. That will be an extra so-and-so, please. Ka-ching. Yeah, it was a money earner for him. And owners needed money, not just to live, not to live a hedonistic lifestyle. Most of them needed it just to keep a roof over their heads. They would do anything.
Clearly. I mean, again, the Lions. Like, I really don't know how we can get past the Lions, but I will try. I will do my best. I'd love to ask you about something that we've not talked about yet, but very much is in the book, and because it had really quite a huge impact at the time, the V&A put on an exhibit titled The Destruction of the Country House. And yet, you talk about in the book, it actually quite benefited country houses. Why?
Yeah, I mean, the Destruction of the Country House exhibition in 1974 at the V&A was, without doubt, it was a landmark. It changed a lot of thinking about the country house. It had a political motive to it. Dennis Healey, as Chancellor of the Labour government, was talking about bringing in a wealth tax. That is a tax, an annual tax on assets rather than on the transfer of assets, which a capital gains tax, capital transfer tax was. This would have, as far as a lot of people were concerned, this would have heralded the death of the country house, because country house owners were asset rich and cash poor. They couldn't afford to pay a wealth tax. So the story went anyway. And in fact, Dennis Healey quite quickly dropped the idea of a wealth tax. But the exhibition, which went on in 74, late 74, was a remarkable reminder to people of the number of country houses that had gone, would have been lost forever. Hundreds, hundreds of houses. I think since 1918, between 1918 and 1974, something like 400 or 500 houses. And some of them really very important houses had gone. And this exhibition, people knew maybe that the country house in the next village to them or the next, you know, on the outskirts of their town had been turned into an old people's home or a prep school and it had failed and it had been demolished. They knew odd ones. Nobody apart from pioneering conservationists, the people who set up the exhibition, Marcus Binney, John Harris, apart from them, most people weren't aware of the losses. And the destruction exhibition just opened people's eyes. Roy Strong, who was the union director then at the V&A, talked about one of the exhibits was The Hall of the Lost, in which John Harris intoned a roll call of all the houses which had been demolished and there were photographs of them. And Roy Strong said he would walk in there sometimes and people would be just standing there with tears streaming down their faces, just appalled by the loss. And what the destruction exhibition did, I think, it made people more aware of what was happening to the country. In fact, country houses weren't being demolished by 1974. The listing mechanisms meant that you needed to get a listed building consent to demolish a historic house, and there were very few demolitions. But it just made people think again about the importance of the country house in British culture. And you've got two more events, I think, which I always think are pivotal in this. After the 74 exhibition, you've got Mark Gerard's masterly Life in the English Country House, a social and political, social and historic survey, whatever it's called, Life in the English Country House. That came out in 78. And that was one of the first books to look at how a house was lived in. You know, when I was working at Sudbury Hall, to go right back to the beginning of our talk, when I was working at Sudbury Hall, people were asking where the servants slept, where the kitchens. We didn't show them that. We showed them the decorative plasterwork and the paintings. We didn't want, people weren't going to be interested in how houses worked, were they? Well, yes, they were. And Gerard's book really gave an impetus to the cult of the country house. And the third thing, I think, after the destruction exhibition in 74 and Gerard's Life in the English Country House in 78, was in 79-80, Granada's dramatisation of Brideshead Revisited, which again presented this kind of elegiac, rather sentimental view of a world that we were losing. And that just made people want to go out and see it. And you could tell. I mean, I was active in the country house world in the early mid-80s onwards. And you could run an evening class. And if you put country house in the title, you'd be oversubscribed two or three times over. You packed out village halls and further education colleges. Visits went up, the number of visits to country houses shot up in the late 70s, 80s. National Trust membership rocketed up in the, I think it hit a million in 1980, something like that. But, it increased out of all proportion. People wanted to see country houses because they thought they were losing them. They weren't losing them, in fact, to be honest, but they might have done. And that threat, that perceived threat, made them much more exciting, I think.
And in many ways kind of takes us up to the present day, which of course makes sense, given that that's where the book ends, kind of setting us, just solving that puzzle and helping us understand how we got from then to now. So I only really have one question left, and I admit I do already know a bit of the answer, but would you like to share with our listeners what you might have been working on since this book was published?
I would love to, yes. I wrote The Long Weekend 7 or 8 years ago about the interwar country house, Noble Ambitions about the postwar country house. I've just finished a book called The Power and the Glory. I stole the title from Graham Greene, The Power and the Glory, about the country house in late Victorian and Edwardian Britain in the years, the decades before the First World War. So it will actually be the final part of a trilogy of 100 years of country house life. It's just that I'm doing the first part last. And it's wonderfully exciting to me anyway. I hope it will be exciting to my readers as well. It looks not only at the arrival of new technologies and new architectures, it also explores the conventional idea of the country house owner, and it disputes the conventional idea we have of the country house owner. And look at Anglo-Jewish country houses, Anglo-American country houses in this country, of course, Indian princes like Duleep Singh, the last Maharaja of the Sikh Empire, and his magnificent country house at Elverdale in Suffolk. We look at nouveau riche industrialists like William Armstrong, the armaments manufacturer, Craigside. And it just served, as I was doing the book, it demonstrated to me how difficult it is to generalize about social groups, about the typical country squire and his wife and the girls teaching in the Sunday school, the boys going to Eton and then the army and then coming back to run the estate. Those kind of typical models are not typical. There are so many exceptions, but there's no rule.
Well, I look forward to learning more about this because, listeners, we're going to have Adrian back and he's going to tell us even more about The Power and the Glory when it comes out later this year. So stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, you can read the final part of the trilogy before we get to the beginning, the book we've been discussing titled Noble Ambitions, The Fall and Rise of the Postwar Country House. Adrian, thank you so much for being with us and I look forward to our next interview.
Thank you very much indeed, Miranda. Thank you, and I look forward to it too.